live and do.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Stonewall Live. My name is Nate Klarfeld, and for the next half hour, we're going to bring you the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Good evening from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm Nate Klarfeld, and today I have Spencer Lord on the line. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to talk about his great book.
My name is Nate Klarfeld.
What's it doing? For the next half hour, we're going to bring you the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk. Blog Talk Radio.
Whoops.
What is it playing again? Good evening from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm Nate Klarfeld, and today I have Spencer Lord on the line. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to talk about his great book. Spencer, what's going on?
I don't know. I'm getting an echo. You're echoing.
I'm trying to get rid of it. I'm getting rid of it.
Sure.
It won't turn off. What's going on?
All right. This is Stonewall Lock.
Won't go off.
Well, I mean, you know, when you want to wait a few minutes, I'm
Spencer, what's going on? Okay, we're
know,
done.
I'm getting an echo. You're echoing.
Okay, let's not worry about the echo. Oh, you've got your thing on. Turn it off. It's your
what thing.
You've got your computer on, right?
No, I'm not anywhere near a computer.
Okay.
Well, I mean, you know, when you want to wait a few minutes, I'm
good. I've got. Oh, it's me. It's me. Okay. Okay, we're fine now. I'm sorry, I was one. Okay, Spencer.
Oh, okay.
I was blown away when I read your book. I read your book about almost 8 months ago, and I'm not one to be really needing of I wasn't a depressed person. I love my life. I love myself, and I can honestly tell you that 2 hours with your book absolutely changed my life.
Oh, well, thanks, Nate. That's, it's interesting you say that because it changed my life so radically when I read it and when I found out about CBT that I thought, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this isn't required for everybody in, you know, grammar school, high school, college, why it wasn't required. So I'm really glad to hear that, and I get a lot of mail about that same thing. So that's super. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So tell us how you got to this. How did you get to this place in your life?
Well, I was preparing for grad school. I was going to follow in my mother's footsteps and be a psychotherapist. She works with, for past 15 years, she's worked with high-risk kids and used cognitive therapy. And I said, what should I read to get sort of a jump on I'm going to be in for? She said, read Judith Beck, Aaron Beck, Albert Ellis, and David Burns. And these are sort of the great, great, you know, edifices of cognitive therapy. And I thought, okay, I will. And so I ordered a bunch of the books, and I sat down, and I started reading them. And it was about 2 weeks into this that it so blew me away that I didn't realize you could actually look at the world that way. To me, it was like, you know, it was what Einstein did to physics with relativity is what Albert Ellis and Aaron Beck did to psychology with cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, it really blew me away, and I thought, okay. I have to read more and more and more. So I had a pile of about 50 books. And as I went through them, I became frustrated because I thought, you know what, you could teach this a lot easier if you broke it down into simpler concepts, you use very straightforward analogs, you use sort of, you know, easier metaphors and stories. But I thought, you know, maybe a lot of those people were writing sort of as PhDs to PhDs, and that's not what they were going for, the Cliff Note layman's guide. So I thought there is definitely a need for this kind of a summary of this, and that way people can get the basic ideas and concepts of cognitive therapy, and then they can either seek out their own therapist or go read other books or whatever, or just use the exercises that are in the book to, you know, change things in their day-to-day life with emotional disturbances. So it's been a long process, but boy, I'm sure grateful it happened.
Yes, and a lot of thousands of others are too. I'm going to read you a quote from the book that is on a 3x5 card taped to my monitor. I swear to God.
Oh, super.
I'm reading it right off my monitor. An emotional feeling, although it is affected by an event, does not and cannot directly result from it. Talk to us about that.
Amen. Well, here's the basic premise is most people believe that have believed most of their lives that emotions are a function of events, that when events happen to them in life, they have emotional responses that are caused by those events. But once you learn the cognitive model, you learn that in between the events that happen in our lives and our emotional responses to those events is a different piece, which is our belief system or our opinions about those events that happen. So, and then the more you study it, you learn that we have power to control our opinions or our beliefs, which is the thing in the middle, the variable between events and emotions. And when you affect the belief you have about an event in the middle, you end up with a different emotional response to that event. And cognitive therapy basically teaches you a new set of thinking skills that you learn to look at the world differently, you learn to look at events differently, and realize that you don't have to be controlled emotionally by things that happen, but there is something in between that you have some power over. And, of course, events in life we don't have much power over. And once you have an emotional response to an event, you don't have a lot of control over that. But this piece in the middle is what cognitive therapy focuses on, which is our belief system. And so it basically, you know, we're looking at changing thought processes and changing the way we think. And when you change the way you think, it automatically changes the way you feel. So you don't have to be pushing against the emotion. The emotion changes automatically in response to your thinking process change.
Great, great. Okay, this is the other word that I picked up in the book. It's been about a year since I've read the first edition. I guess there's a new edition out. I've got both covers in front of me right now.
Right.
That I now call, when I get, you know, teed off, pissed off, I say, oh, that's my lizard brain.
right. Yes, yeah, your lizard brain. Your lizigdala, the lizard brain in your head, which is your amygdala, as you know.
Right, the amygdala is part of the brain. I'm just, you know, giving a little short anatomy lesson. Spencer does a great job in the book, but he's renamed it the lizigdala. I'm sorry, lizigdala, and meaning the lizard brain, the oldest part of your brain, your fight or flight. Go ahead and talk about that a little bit.
Well, basically, it's way down deep in the brain. It's one of the oldest parts of the brain that goes back to lizards, goes back actually to amphibians, the amygdala. And it's sort of a seat of really intense emotions, emotional responses. It was designed to protect us with fear and fight and flight and fright and all that stuff. And so it's responsible for sending powerful emotional signals upwards and outwards into the other parts of our brain, mainly into our prefrontal cortex, which is at the front of the brain. Your prefrontal cortex is sort of your CEO, the center of self. It's, you know, it's what you consider you. It's the part of the brain that plans for the future. And it's, you know, the most developed part of the brain in primates and clear up into Homo sapien, which has it in spades, of course. And but the amygdala, way down deep, can be sparked by things that happen to you. As far as the event can start an emotional response in your amygdala, and or your thoughts, by thinking something in your prefrontal cortex, can actually then start an emotional response in your amygdala. And another part of what therapy, in this kind of therapy, you learn is that once you learn to sort of identify where an emotion is coming from, as far as if it's based the fight or flight stuff from the amygdala, or whether it's your thinking with your prefrontal cortex, things that cause those responses, you learn better how to manipulate how you respond to things, and you keep your brain from getting overheated. Because what happens is every time the amygdala sends a signal that would spark an emotional response to something, once it reaches your prefrontal cortex, you can either... It either meets a rational belief there that slows it down, or it meets an irrational belief there which speeds it up and reinforces it. So once it starts, if it then hits your conscious brain, your prefrontal cortex, and you think something irrational about it that reinforces it, it continues to get worse. You get stuck on the idea and it overheats, and you know the emotion becomes more intense. But what cognitive therapy helps you learn is when you feel that initial tiny signal coming, that you can intervene, that you can change the irrational thought in your prefrontal cortex to a rational thought. And when you change from an irrational to a rational, it short circuits that loop, that sort of stuck feeling where we get overheated and where we get carried away on anger, anxiety, fear, jealousy, worry, guilt, depression, that you have more power than you believed you had over controlling that. And, manipulating it to keep you from really getting stuck in dangerous emotional responses.
Right. I know. And the real part that I found after I read the book was I was more aware of that split second. I think that split second when you realize you've got the signal, the trigger, whether it's anger, jealousy, you went over the words, but there's that. I guess the hardest thing for me anyway is to work on the awareness. You know that recognizing that moment and not going into autopilot.
Right. No, you're absolutely right, and that's one really powerful thing about cognitive therapy is that you start to think about thinking, and that's really a huge part of it. A lot of people just don't realize, and that's what I guess my own story and history with this is. I hadn't ever stopped to really think about what I was thinking about, and that very step, once you start, looking at thought processes and emotional responses, you start to learn that there are moments in there, like you said, that awareness when that signal starts. There are moments in there where you have a whole lot more control over where that signal ends up than you used to think you had, and that intervening early in those thoughts actually gives you a huge edge in overcoming them and not being, not suffering from the negative emotional responses that most of our lives, nobody ever told us we had any control over. I lived 36 years of my life thinking I just, had to suffer with this stuff or something happened and I felt this in response to it. What can I do? Well, no, what you learn is through cognitive behavioral therapy and the cognitive model, you start to think about thinking. And when you start to think about thinking, just like you said, you become aware. And that awareness is a really big deal and it really helps in, intervening and saving yourself from a lot of trouble that we've experienced in our lives.
Right, right. Tell us how the book has been received and where it's being used now. I think it's just absolutely fascinating. I've been following the book on Publishers Weekly and places like that. Go ahead.
Right. Thank you so much for following it. Initially I had a lot of friends that I had sent it to and people that I've known for over the years responded really well to it. And finally it was endorsed by Cheryl Sabin, who's a PhD in psychology and a philanthropist in Los Angeles. She's really a genius. She's written a lot about cognitive therapy. And then a clinical director of a psychiatric hospital, Rhonda Noonan, she responded really well. And she's prescribed it actually as bibliotherapy for her patients. And once I had heard that, I started to give it to other people in the psychological sciences, psychiatrists, psychologists. And they read it and said, wow, this is really great because I can give this to a patient and they can take it home and in 90 minutes they can read it, which is really fast read. And then everybody speaks the same language. Another important part of it is you learn the same terms, you can talk about the same ideas, you learn the basic structure of how your emotions and your thoughts work, and then everybody sort of speaks the same language. Now it's gone, in fact, on to be a textbook at Columbia College in Chicago. And,
wow.
And it's really getting some huge response, and people are using it to teach in their own private, coaches, life coaches are using it to
right.
teach people. So I'm just hoping that the more the psychological community reads it, the more excited they'll be, like others have already told me, about the fact that somebody from my side of the process has written it, because most of everything that's available out there is from, these PhDs that have been doing this for years and years, and maybe they forgot, how much simpler it could be for somebody that's a layman. I'm an average Joe. I was a linguistics major, so I'm more of a communicator. And what I did was I took these 50,000 pages and I summarized them in a way that are really accessible. And so I've been really happy about the response because so much of my mail is even from students and psychologists that are practicing, says basically, I am so grateful somebody has broken this down in a format that I can give somebody or that somebody can easily read and understand. And they're using it in adjunct with all kinds of other therapies. So I'm really excited about that.
Great. Yeah, it's an amazing book. I've recommended it to people. I know people that immediately downloaded it on their Kindle. It's a really amazing book. We're going to switch gears here. You worked with Mother Teresa, which of course is on your introduction, and you credit her with the reason that book exists. Could you tell us more? Because anything with Mother Teresa we want to hear about. Go ahead, please.
Sure. Well, yeah, I was in Asia. I had been in Thailand and Indonesia for a while, and I thought I wanted to go to Calcutta to see if I could, I'd always been impressed and sort of fascinated by her and her work. And I flew to Calcutta from Bangkok, and I landed and went straight over to the Mother House in 54A Lower Circular Road. I rang the little bell, and they asked me to come in and wait in the parlor, and I could see her at 5 o'clock. So I was shocked that she was even there and that I could have an audience. She came down at 5 o'clock. She handed me what she calls her business card with a little Catholic prayer on it and a St. Teresa medallion and told me that the Lord had sent me there to work for her. So I didn't have the, you know, I couldn't tell her, no, sorry, I have a two-week ticket home. So I stayed on, and I started working, and I worked at Shishibawan, which is an orphanage, and Kaligat, the home for the dying. And she became, you know, she became really my first Indian friend. She was really sweet to me, and she was so good to all the volunteers. And, you know, anybody that showed up around there in the early 90s got to spend all the time we wanted at the mother house, in, you know, with her and in missions and going out and medicating people with dapsone and feeding people and working in all the different missions she had in Calcutta. So, but what was interesting is that at that point in my life, I really didn't think there was a I didn't believe in the concept of belief just for the sake of belief. I thought, you know, you should have overwhelming evidence before you should believe something. I was, you know, totally agnostic. I'm still agnostic, but I was an agnostic that didn't think there was any room for what was called faith. I thought that's kind of silly to believe something without any evidence. Well, over the years, I've kept her very close to my heart, and she had a deep influence on me. And when I came into cognitive therapy, what I realized was that that part in the middle that we were talking about between emotions and between events and emotional responses, that believe part, well, beliefs are incredibly important. And the reason they're so important is because they're fluid. They can change. You can change
right.
them. Most people don't know that. And when that hit me for the first time in cognitive therapy, I can change what I believe from as basic as colors. Beliefs, what's your favorite color? Blue, green, orange, red? Well, it's your favorite color is a belief. What kind of food you like is a belief. What kind of music you like is a belief. These are all called opinions. Well, an opinion is simply a belief. And I guess, you know, most of my life I thought I was stuck not only with emotional responses to events, I thought I was stuck with these beliefs. I had to believe all this stuff. Well, guess what? It's really amazing the day you realize I can believe anything I want to and that we have control over the brain is sort of a belief machine. And so the reason I credit it with her is it really took me back full circle to, you know, she had talked about faith for so long and about the importance of belief. And I had always thought, well, you know, she doesn't quite get how science really works. And now what I've discovered is that the most evidence-based form of psychotherapy, which has been proven in thousands of studies in double-blind, peer-reviewed control group, hard science, statistically significant results studies, is that your beliefs play a powerful role in your emotional health and your psychological health, and that when you learn how to change your beliefs through rational argument with yourself, or even some people can just do it on whim, which is just as long as you get the belief changed, that really what she was onto was the most powerful thing that humans have in their entire arsenal, which is their belief system. And the reason beliefs are so powerful is not for the old reason we're always told they're powerful, which is because once you got them, you got to hang on to them and never let them go. No, guess
right.
what? The reason beliefs are so powerful is because you can alter them. You can change them. You can make them anything you want to make them. And that the letting go of some beliefs that are not healthy and the changing of beliefs from irrational to rational actually is the most powerful tool people have in their entire sort of psychological quiver.
Yes, I know. In fact, there's a great quote I repeat sometimes to people when they seem stuck to me or when I'm stuck with myself, is in that quote of the French philosopher Montaigne said, "My life has been filled with terrible misfortunes, most of which have never happened." And that's
Great. That's really great.
Isn't that
yeah,
great?
That's a great example. Oh, that's terrific. I might have to use that because, yeah, that would be, yeah, that's the anxiety. The people, you know, the
right.
people believing these things have happened that haven't even happened. So that's a
right.
great study in irrational beliefs.
Correct. And that's 200 years old.
Wow.
Somebody was, and he did not have double-blind peer-reviewed studies to say that.
Of course. Right. Okay, yeah. Well, and as you know, it goes all the way back to Epictetus, who said, you know, the quote in the book about, you know, you can that basically it's not things right. that disturb men, but it's their opinions about things. It's not events right. that disturb men, but their opinions about events. And the most basic example you can use is two neighbor guys live next door to each other. One's scheduled to work Saturday morning, one's scheduled to go golfing. Well, they both go to bed. They wake up and it's pouring down torrential rainstorm. One of them is really angry and annoyed. The other's just overjoyed. Well, it's absurd to assert that a rainstorm can cause one person to be happy and one person to be sad.
Right.
It's all about – it's other things that are tied up. It can't be the event. It's about the schedule. It's about what they believed about the day. It was about them being blue, that they couldn't continue with a plan. There's a whole lot of other stuff psychologically tied up there that causes one man to be happy and one man to be sad. It has nothing to do with rain. If your house
right.
is on fire, nothing could be happier than a thunderstorm.
Right, exactly. That's very true. Last week, you were in the green room during what's going to be probably one of the most famous Oprah Winfrey episodes with a friend of yours. For those just reminding you, last Tuesday of this week, Oprah Winfrey show in her last season did a show on LGBT gay coming out, and it was her 120th show with a gay or transsexual theme.
Right.
And Spencer was there with a friend, and he's going to talk to us about it because we want to hear everything about Oprah there is to hear.
Oh, my gosh, she's amazing. I had always been a fan because I had been in Chicago for so long. But this was the first time I actually had spent time with her. I went with Prince Van Vinder, whom you know and have talked to, and you will be talking to again on your show soon.
Thank you.
Yes, of course. Prince Van Vinder is the only openly gay member of Indian royal family. And in fact, right now, as far as I know, the only openly gay royal in the world. And Oprah had him on years ago and really liked his story. And after his story aired, it just so changed so many parts of India. Just the story of that the acceptance that he's gotten from Oprah Winfrey really had an effect in India. And he's become the most visible figure for LGBT rights across India. And that's, you know, 1.2 billion people. So
Wow. It is
tens and tens of millions of GLBT Indians. So, you know, she had him back because she was doing her final, you know, this is her final season, 62 shows left. And
I
had been over there. I had spent 4 months just recently working for his trust, Lakshya Trust, that works for HIV/AIDS, human rights, you know, runs a free clinic, does free testing, does free medication. It's just a massive operation that is saving and affecting tens of thousands of lives in Gujarat, which is the state he lives in.
Mm-hmm.
So I had come back home, and Sherry Salata, who's Oprah's, the president of Harpo Studios, the books and the magazine and the website and the cable and all of it, had read The Brain Mechanic and really liked it. And when I was headed to India, I thought, okay, well, maybe I can make another connection here. I contacted Prince Van Vinder, and he invited me to his music festival, and then I ended up working for him. Well, we were online a couple of weeks ago, late at night, and he said, oh, I just got a call. I'm going to come back to Oprah. So we all got excited and went to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, we went in, and I took a bunch of other friends, and we went to the green room, and we're all excited to be, you know, to be in the royal caravan to Harpo, which is American royalty, I guess, in a way.
Sure. Oh,
and,
my God.
Yeah, she's incredible. We recorded the show. After the show, we were all back in the green room, and Oprah came in, and she spent about 45 minutes with us, hugs
what?
And conversation, and just incredibly warm, incredibly nice. I tell you, when she didn't come in before the show, we taped it all. I was really thrilled because it was still like Oprah Winfrey, but I was a little blue deep down. I thought, oh, well, I would have loved to have met her. You know, I hate to,
right.
it, you know, you can't discredit the event, but I sure would have loved to have met her. And it was really neat at the end. She came back in and she spent so much time with us. And she announced to the entire studio at the end of the show and on air that she's going to be going to India. She wraps her show in 62 more episodes. And then in 2012,
right.
on her cards for production are India. So she's going to be going to stay in Manvendra's Pink Palace
wow.
in Gujarat, India. So now there's much, you know, there's a lot of buzz. The king and queen are, of course, buzzing because they've got about a year to prepare for Oprah to come to the palace.
Yeah, it would take them longer than a year to prepare for Oprah.
I know, exactly. I don't think I could ever be quite ready.
I'd have to call the other Nate, Nate Berkus, to help me
right.
with the house.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Your namesake. Well, we've actually wondered. We've thought about finding out if maybe Nate could come and renovate a room and do the Oprah Winfrey suite at the Palace ahead of time. Who knows?
Well,
it would be fun.
Right. Well, you know, Nate Berkus has just redone the GLBT homeless shelter in New York City. He just finished doing that. In fact, I'm in contact with him.
Oh, that's
on the show.
Terrific. And,
well, maybe he'll do one of the clinics over there.
Do you know if that's the Alley? Is that the Alley Forney Center?
Yeah,
do you know?
Just at Alley Forney. He just did a like a.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he just redid one of the rooms just like last week.
Oh, okay. Well, isn't that interesting? Because this Tuesday, February 1st, I'll be in New York City. I'm in New York City now, which, by the way, just had a blizzard. We are covered in so much. You've never seen. It was like The Shining last night. I've never seen so much snow outside of Chicago anywhere in my life.
Yeah.
But Tuesday is I'm co-hosting a birthday party for Ronnie Kroll, who was on the Bravo TV show Make Me a Supermodel. So he was Bravo, you know, Bravo TV supermodel Ronnie Kroll. Who's out and proud, of course, is having his 28th birthday Tuesday in New York. So I hope if anyone's listening from New York, also they'll get their ticket online and come on down to Hudson Terrace in New York City Tuesday night, and the proceeds go to benefit Alley Forney. So it's really great. Anything we can do for, you know, homeless LGBT youth, because God knows, you know, any for the grace of God, any of us could have been there. So
right, I know. I work with some GSA, Gay Straight Alliances, here in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale, and you know, I just leave there crying, crying of happiness that they have that outlet in school. You know, in the lunchroom, in the locker room, that they have.
Right.
Allies, you know, that they have allies that were not there a few years ago. You're a very giving person, a very sharing person. I'm very impressed about this whole. This whole interview has just been so amazing.
Well, thank you. I'm really honored to be on the show, Nate, and I hope I can't wait till I'm in Fort Lauderdale, because I want to see you and I want to see Grover and I want to see everybody, and I'm hoping one day we can maybe organize even a cruise. You know, there's so much to be done. So
yeah.
I would love to organize a cruise, and more, and certainly if you two can ever get to India, come and you've already spoken to His Highness on the phone, and you're certainly
right.
going to be more than welcome to visit, and he'll be on your show when we figure out the Skype technology. So he'll be on your show, and
let's get our India connection. We're set, you know, here. But yeah, we are.
That's right. Yeah, you are now. And well, and here's what's really appropriate, because, you know, Stonewall, India, 18 months ago, a high court ruling decriminalized homosexuality in India. So for this, you know, for this 50 to 100 million LGBTs that live there, this is their Stonewall. India is 18 months into their Stonewall. The first pride parades, the first, you know, shops for gay, you know, for literature, and the first, the prince has published the first magazine. This is their Stonewall, and it's time to reach across the pond and support them.
Right. Yes. Any people who speak the language, you can get Fun actually mailed here. If you get on the website, they have a Facebook page where you can order the magazine and have it shipped over from India here in the United States. And it's in an incredible format. We've already ordered it for the library, and it's just absolutely amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
And the brilliant part is we all speak the same language, thanks to British colonization.
Right, and it's not, well, it's language, but it does have the culture. I flipped through it, and there's an online version. There is a difference in culture. The Indian culture is a lot more polite, of course.
Way more conservative.
Yeah, they're way less in your face. So it's kind of like the nice, clean gay magazine without all the junk and all the, you know, the jiggles. It's like nothing.
Well, they are very conservative. If anybody hasn't been to India, anyone who has been there knows that there is no nudity. There is no porn shops. There's no nudity on the TV, none on the movie screen. India is a very conservative culture. So, and it's nice to see, you know, it is refreshing to know that his magazine fits into that, you know, mold, and that it's but that's part of what is going to really help out with visibility in India. If you went all out about it,
well,
pornographic or whatever,
we didn't go all out here really for a long time either.
Right.
It's an organic process. I believe that, and every city is different. Every city in the United States has a different gay community.
Right. Well, and now you're playing a role. Us sitting here talking about this on the air is playing a role in the process. So we're taking part now in India's Stonewall.
Right. I'm just amazed. I'm absolutely amazed. Listen, we're just about ready to wrap it up. And you have 30 seconds to tell us exactly what in your personal life you'd like to do. What's next?
In my it's a tour. I want to spend, I've got 11 more months on the road. I'll be back in India in March, but I've got 11 months on the road signing books at Borders and Barnes & Noble, soon, you know, your favorite local bookstore, if I can get
right.
anywhere near where everybody's listening. And I really want everybody to be able to get their hands on a copy. Go to brainmechanicbook.com, go to Amazon, or just Google it or Google my page. You can get there 100 ways, whether you buy it on Amazon, it's inexpensive, $8 or whatever, and or get it in your local favorite bookstore. Right now, my life is that.
Good. Okay. Thank you, Spencer, and I will be speaking with you soon. Thank you so much for visiting Stonewall Live.
Perfect. Thanks, Nate, and thanks to all your listeners.